This week on the show, pulling the plug on cable. Will Netflix take its place? And traditional journalists versus Joe Sixpack. All this on This Week in Media, episode 111. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another installment of the show. I'm Daisy Whitney. I'm hosting this week. I am with TV Week, the New Media Minute, various other publications and places and all of that on the web. So anyway, and we have an all-girls show again.
Woohoo!
We did one earlier this summer, and now we have another one. So that woohoo that you heard is from none other than Dr. Kiki. She's in the studio with me. Thank you for joining me.
You're welcome. I wouldn't want you to be completely alone in here. I mean, Lane's here, but he gets to be quiet.
Hi, Lane. Maybe we'll let you talk sometime, Lane. He has, you know, Lane is our sound engineer. He actually has, like, really great points. You know, he helps with the, what do you call it, the show outros or intros, you know, coming up with what to say, like the catchphrases. So so we'll let you He's totally embarrassed.
He's
That's what we're doing since we have an all-girl show. And we have Skyping in. I think both of our guests are first-time guests. That's very exciting. In Los Angeles is Zadie Diaz. Hello, Zadie.
Hey, how are you? Very excited to be on the show.
Thank you for being on. Zadie is the host of Epic Foo, as you probably know. She is wonderful at her job, and her show, formerly Next New Networks, now our Vision 3 show, and I assume it's doing well.
Yeah, it's doing really well. We're having a lot of fun, you know, have a lot of guests on, so it's doing well.
All right, that's good to hear. And we also have from New York, Stephanie Scott is Skyping. Hi, Steph.
Hi, everybody.
Steph,
greetings,
is
New York.
Steph is the creator, star of The Retributioners, which
that
is a
correct
web series, which is about kind of getting even with people who've screwed you in life, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. You captured that absolutely correctly.
Hence the name, The Retributioners. So I've seen most of the episodes. Now, my favorite one, we should get a link for this. We'll try to put this up in the show notes. My favorite episode, and the very first one I saw of Steffi's show, is the drunk dialing one. It's hilarious. She drunk dials all of her people who have wronged her, like, in the past, and just, you know, in this haze, tells them everything that they did wrong. It's pretty funny. So we'll link that up, definitely, so you guys can check that out. So I want to get started with interesting news going on, and then, you know, obviously we'll get some thoughts, as we usually do, from our guests. The first thing I want to talk about, though, is news that just came out late last week, early this week. It's being talked about more and more on the blogosphere and whatnot, and that is that YouTube is, I'm not sure if these are actually up and running yet, but YouTube is going to be streaming some full-length TV shows with commercials in them. And I believe that this is starting through a partnership with CBS. And I think I read somewhere that one of the shows was MacGyver. Somebody joked about that, like, wow, there's 1,300 views so far for MacGyver. But I think that their goal is to have some Showtime shows as well, like Dexter and Californication. And of course, this is a big deal for YouTube to do this, because YouTube, as it started exploring ad models just 1 year ago, I mean, it really was in September of 2007 that YouTube first started putting ads on the site, has been reluctant to include pre-roll ads. Now, when YouTube starts offering full-length TV shows, those will come, of course, with ads. I'm not sure if the ads are going to be sold by YouTube. Actually, I think the networks are going to be doing most of that, because that's inventory that they would want to control. But anyway, this is a big step forward. Jordan Hoffner, the head of content partnerships, said one of the reasons they did this was because of the success, clearly, we've seen from ABC.com, NBC.com, and whatnot. So what do we think about this? Dr. Kiki, I want to start with you, because we were kind of gabbing about this beforehand. What are your thoughts? And then we'll go around the horn.
Well, I think it's really, you know, anything that starts putting full-length episodes of programs on the internet for streaming, I think, is fabulous. But YouTube has historically had a problem with compression. I think the compression is always low. The quality is never very good. I mean, they have started offering their higher definition offer. So, you know, that's if they are offering these longer form episodes in the higher definition, I think it's great. But if they're showing stuff in the low compression format, I don't want to watch it. I mean, why do I want to sit and watch giant pixels for, you know, an hour?
Giant Pixels. Let's make a show called Giant Pixels. Zadi, what do you think about this? Will this cause more people to ditch their cable service and say, wow, if I can get everything on YouTube, why do I need to get... Even if it's not cable shows that you're watching, of course, let's remember that when you do have cable and satellite service, it's often easier. I'm not saying it's the only way, but it's often easier to get high-definition quality. So what do you think, Zadi?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm kind of processing this now. I was offline for about a week and thinking about how I get my entertainment on the web, I kind of like that sense of having uninterrupted entertainment. And I'm wondering what length the commercials will ultimately be. What'll be the Hulu model where it's, you know, just a few, 15-second, 30-second commercials, you know, three or four, or are they going to kind of follow the television model where you have, you know, an abundance of commercials within the 30-minute or hour programming? So I'd be interested in how that's going to play out, just because, you know, I'd then prefer to BitTorrent a show and not have to deal with the commercials.
So, Steph, what are your thoughts on this, on watching full-length TV shows on YouTube?
I'm going to have to agree with Dr. Kiki on this one regarding the compression. I'm all for watching full-length TV shows on the web. I have done it, and I do it currently. Whenever I miss an episode of 30 Rock, let's say, I'll go to the NBC.com website, and they have the pre-roll ads. They'll have actually four of them. They'll split the show into four different segments, and I don't mind it because at least, you know, it's on demand. I'm getting that episode, and I'm watching what I missed, but the quality of it on that site is excellent, and so I don't know how that's going to work for YouTube. I know that when I post my own web shows, YouTube happens to be the last one I wind up uploading my web show to because I know that the compression and the quality of it isn't as great as, let's say, Blip.
Now, Dr. Kiki, I know we're both Grey's Anatomy fans. Of course, others may be as well. Do you now, have you watched Grey's on ABC.com or online, or do you just watch it on TV?
Just television.
Because I've watched them both places, and, you know, with luck, I mean, there's nothing like Dr. McDreamy at 52
right
inches.
You gotta love it.
But I have watched a few episodes on ABC.com and on iTunes as well, and the quality there is very good. And I suspect what we will see from YouTube is, again, it's going to be similar to how ads look on Hulu, because that's how consumers are being trained. They're being trained when they watch TV shows online. They're accustomed to that. And this is actually particularly interesting to me because I just posted a column on TV Week today. And so hopefully everybody, if you get a chance, weigh in, because it's actually a vote where I am offering myself up as a guinea pig of sorts to try to go cable free. And, you know, certainly, wow. I mean, as many of you know, I talk to listeners, we email, we talk on Twitter and whatnot, and, you know, people often say, Daisy, get rid of your cable. Of course, it's funny, my web designer said, well, how else would we know what's on it if you didn't have cable, because you're the only person who does? But anyways, if you go to TVWeek.com, you can vote for whether I should get rid of my cable programming service, because I really wanted to see, okay, what is it like? I mean, we all know, I mean, Alex talks about it, how he doesn't have cable, and iJustine, when she's been on the show and in other places, you know, she watches everything solely online. Zadi, do you have cable service at all?
I do have cable, but I hardly watch it. I get all of my entertainment through the web, really. And when I do watch anything on television, it's because I either record it on my DVR or, you know, a friend has told me, you know, to record a show, but I generally don't watch TV that much.
And that's what I'm going to miss the most, I've realized, because over the last week, as I wrote the column last week, so I knew that, you know, that I knew that, look, people are probably going to vote to have me get rid of my cable service, right? Because it's kind of more fun. I mean, it's kind of more, like, cool, except for, like, my few PR buddies at the cable firms, like Cablevision and Comcast, will maybe try to vote, like, don't get rid of it. But the whole point of it really is to see, because I think more and more consumers are going to be doing this. I mean, the Wall Street Journal had a story last week. Will Richman at videonews.com, which is spelled video, N-U-Z-E.com, talks about this as well. Just, are we ready yet? Is the technology and the accessibility of it at the point where more everyday average consumers are going to feel comfortable? So I really want to give it a shot and see, okay, what is it that I'm going to miss? I do think it's the DVR that I'm going to miss more than anything. Mm-hmm. But I was happy to hear about these shows, because one of the things I will, of course, be giving up when I give up the cable service was HBO and Showtime, and that's Entourage and Californication. And those, of course, are not available immediately online unless I do the BitTorrent thing. And I guess I'm just afraid that somehow I'd get caught and then there'd be a lawsuit against me and then I'd be in big trouble and then I'd have to go to jail or something. And anyway, so I haven't quite gone the BitTorrent route yet. I know my editor would just be so, like, he's so against piracy. My editor at TV Week, like, Daisy, you can't do that. You have to do this the right way. So anyway, speaking of piracy, hey, how about that? That's a perfect lead into our next story. New TV predicted back in June, based on the popularity of leaked TV show pilots, which shows will get canceled. And it turned out that the blog was right. So New TV predicted that Do Not Disturb would get the axe. And that was actually, I think that was the Jason Bateman show, right? That was one of the first fall shows after two episodes, I believe, to get the axe. And one of the ways that New TV predicted this was based on what file sharers were saying in response to the leaked pilot. And of course, their verdict was early cancellation. Now, Fringe, which is the new J.J. Abrams show, and of course, J.J. Abrams, expect shows to be good from the Lost creator. But nevertheless, that was his show Fringe fared very well with the file sharers, and it's actually the first show that has been picked up now for the full season. I don't know, I just think this is kind of fascinating, and I wonder what can networks, producers, independent content creators like all of us here, I don't know, is there any way to kind of harness this information and use it somehow to figure out what to do with our shows? What do you think, Dr. Kiki?
Well, I think there's always, you know, some amount of the wisdom of the crowds. There's a certain amount of information and knowledge that can be gained from the actions of a group of people. And so I think they're onto something definitely by following the file sharing activity. And, you know, there might be some way that we can, I mean, as independent producers, it's going to be more difficult than if you're working with a larger organization to be able to access the data, to be able to analyze it and figure out what people are doing. But, you know, there is, you know, people are talking about stuff. And so if you, you know, I think getting into the social media and finding, you know, what people are talking about, what do people like, what do people not seem to like, and be able to, you know, figure out how to apply that to our own.
And I wonder, think that'll work. I wonder if it's just sort of a simpler application when you talk about the web shows that most of us do, that in the sense that it is tweaking shows on the fly. It's responding to, if somebody tells you something on Twitter, if enough people say the same thing and it seems like a valid point, then do you tweak the show based on that? Zadi, what sort of, how does Epic Fu as a Revision 3 show, or just, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be because it's a Revision 3 show, but as part of Revision 3 and just also as sort of its own property, how do you sort of incorporate that same idea of listening to the file sharers? In your case, it's not necessarily file sharers, it's freely available. But how do you bring that into the work that you do so that you don't get early cancellation?
I mean, what works online, you know, doesn't necessarily mean that it works on television. So the way that we think about it is just doing that. What you're talking about is listening to the conversations that are going on and kind of responding to that. And, you know, but people are generally just attracted to good quality work. And in terms of, you know, what we're talking about, these TV shows that have been canceled, I think, you know, the beauty of torrents is that the good stuff and the stuff that's engaging people in discussion usually gets seeded more often, and that usually bubbles up. And really, generally, just people want to see the good stuff and forget about the rest. So they don't want rehashed comedy or ideas. They want stuff that's fresh and new. So I think that's generally the aesthetic of the online kind of world, or wants, kind of, in terms of entertainment. People just want stuff that's, you know, a little bit on the edge, a little bit different, something that you just don't generally see on TV, even if it is on television, just something new.
And of course, your show is you're out there exploring kind of what is the cutting edge of technology and culture and art and music. How do you, in your role as a journalist, because that's what you are on your show, how do you use the technologies or the services? I don't know if it would be a technorati or whatever it is, but, you know, those type of things that are out there on the web to get a sense of what is getting the buzz in the area that your viewers care about. Because one of the things that I assume you want to do with your show is be the first to talk about this cool new trend. I mean, I remember over the summer, one of the first shows I watched of yours that really caught my attention was when you talked about using Facebook and Google to find pool parties or pools that you could, you know, do pool hopping in or something. Can you tell me how you found that story, please?
So
which isn't legal, by the way, so I wouldn't recommend it to anyone out there.
Yeah, and don't be bit torn either.
No, absolutely not. But I mean, it is kind of giving that sense of accessibility, making ourselves accessible to people. So it's not only, you know, being on Twitter or Facebook or MySpace or any, you know, any of these kind of sites. You want to be everywhere, but when you're on them, giving that sense that people can get to you. And so we get the stories by just people sending them into us, the old-fashioned way through email or through a contact form on our website. But just having all of our information out there throughout all the social networking sites, and being able to have, you know, us and kind of make sure that all the eyeballs are being able to see us wherever they are, just going where the community is, instead of having them have to come to us, is really how we kind of generate that communication and that traffic.
And I wonder if we'll start to see, there were some experiments, I think it might be going on this season. I know Fox was trying to do something where it had a group, I don't know, 1,000, 1,800 people, I'm not sure exactly, but, you know, sort of found this research focus group type and really bounced, had them watch their shows in advance and helped develop sort of community interactive type of features alongside of it. It's interesting because, of course, we are preaching to the converted here. I mean, I think, you know, everybody who has a show is very attuned to, you know, all of the mechanisms that we've talked about already. I mean, in terms of responding to listeners and to viewers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I will be curious to see how TV, traditional TV, starts adapting. I mean, these are the things that Jeff Zucker talked about at the start of the year at NAPI when he made his, you know, famous speech, "We can't trade analog dollars for digital pennies." And if networks start listening, maybe they wouldn't have put Do Not Disturb on the air, and would they have saved some money that way? I don't know how much. I mean, but of course, we're talking about much more money that a TV network could save by not even putting a bad pilot on the air and possibly putting something that would test better with file sharers early on. There's got to be some way.
There are tons of pilots that are made that are never see the light of day.
Yeah.
You know, I know actors, and because I come in the actor community, who work on these pilots, and then they get upset, oh, it's never been seen. I mean, this is an opportunity to really get it shown to the community early, before a fall lineup is even decided, before the networks even decide what they're going to pick up, just like what you're saying, Daisy, to showcase the work, hear what the community is saying, get data on audience demographics, see how they relate to the characters, the storylines. And I think it would be great for actors and actresses to just showcase their work for things that never even get seen.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. Netflix is going to be the big winner in the online video world. I don't know, that's what Saul Hanselt, New York Times, predicts. So he had a blog last week. It's kind of interesting. He said, here's why Netflix will win. I'm just going to read the bullet points that he put out there, and then I think this will be an interesting point to debate. Its existing business already satisfies customers. Streaming video, even if it's not perfect now, is seen as more of a free bonus than a disappointment. Its customers already pay, and it's already getting into the living room. Sales estimates for the Roku Netflix box are in the hundreds of thousands. And I wonder, do we... Look, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not like at the end of the day or 2 or 3 years from now, Netflix is... At least I don't think so. Then again, I could be wrong. I mean, there's only like two banks left standing. So maybe Netflix really will be like Bank of America in the online video world. But barring that, and I don't think Netflix is going to get some large injection of funds from the government. Anyway, it was sort of an interesting point. And I wonder if we can all get our crystal balls out for a few minutes and look ahead in terms of who are the winners. What do we think about his conclusions about Netflix and how it's positioned for the future?
I think he's probably onto something. I think that you know, the box that they're providing is an, you know, if it's easy to implement, it's technology that people are going to take advantage of. I mean, there are the small number of technophiles out there who are going to want to create their own media server and put together their own, you know, their own serving system and that's complicated.
Can you do that, Dr. Kiki? I mean, you're more technically astute than I am. Can you do that?
I haven't yet.
I feel better now.
You know, so it's only a small number of people who are going to go to that effort and understand how to do it and be able to do it. And so for the mass audience, the box that you just plug in that can do everything for you, that's easy to use, that is what's going to make it a success. And so as long as this box is very, you know, easy to work, easy to put and plug in, it's going to work. I think the hardware is the crucial key issue into making it something that people will use and can use.
Roku.
But they've been ahead of the curve historically.
True.
You know, they started the doing the mail order DVDs. So maybe this is something that's going to keep them ahead of the curve.
And the Roku box has been very well received. We had David Rewalt on the show over the summer, and he's using it. He had a lot of nice things to say about it. I mean, it seems as if a lot of the tech bloggers who have it and use it say nice things about it. I know that it's been my husband proffered it up to me as a holiday present. Yes, he's so romantic. Thank you, darling, for that. I didn't want a new diamond ring or anything. I don't need another diamond. The one you gave me is very lovely. It gave me 11 years ago. Sorry.
It's not cable either, so it could count for your not cable,
right?
You know? And then you can get things directly on your television, 52 inches of fun.
See, there you go. Okay, here's the hardest part. Okay, guys, I gotta tell you, that's gonna be the title for the show, 52 inches of fun. Let me tell you what's the hardest part for me about giving up cable is of course you can watch. All the people who run TV stations, whenever I dump for this in one of my stories, like, you can still get high def over the air if you get an antenna. Now, that was part of the deal. My editor said, no, you cannot watch over-the-air channels either. So that was it. He's like, you have to try this for a month. He's like, you have to go no TV. You have to be solely broadband-powered video. So it's the hardest part for me is going to be waiting those 24 hours to see Grace, because I'm used to the Friday night routine. I have my girlfriends that I talk to on Friday morning to have the recap. It's going to be like those people who tape the Packers games, right? And then they just walk around the whole day in green bread with headphones. Like, don't tell me. That's what it's going to be like on Friday. Steph and Dottie.
Yeah.
Does Netflix win? I mean, how do you see Netflix position for the future? And I guess let's open this up to what are the other companies, services, whether it's online services, hardware services, that you think are really well positioned? And looking back now, we could say something like Juice, probably not a great idea. Okay, but hindsight is 2020. So let's look forward. What do we think is well positioned in addition to Netflix?
What's so smart about Netflix is that they build a bridge and they really, understand the real world. You know, just having something in hand and kind of having that added bonus of online, it really indoctrinates people into kind of saying, well, you know what? I understand this. It's completely simple. I pay a fee. I get what I want. I can have it as long as I want, send it back, get something new. I mean, that's really easy. And to have anything as easy as that, I think, is really the recipe for success. I think a lot of people, especially online, or a lot of companies, tend to go really on the bleeding edge of technology where people don't understand what it is that's going on. So as long as you keep it really simple, whatever company it may be, I think that's definitely the start of a successful company.
And I think too often we can forget how important ease of use is, because so many of our listeners are obviously, they're very tech savvy. They know how to do these things, with their eyes closed and their hands tied behind their backs. But when we're really thinking about what will gain traction, it's really important to remember, what is actually easy to use, what looks good when you watch it. I mean, I have the Apple TV, and I think that's pretty easy to use. But I think, if I bought this for my mom, what would that experience be like for her? Would she use that to search for Tina Fey Saturday Night Live videos when you have to punch in each letter individually? I don't know.
Yeah.
Thinking about my mom, and I know that I know that she would not use it. She's still afraid to use the internet right now, and so yeah, it all comes down to simplicity. And I think the jury's still out. And you could tell me if the Roku box, in terms of the Roku box, in terms of its quality.
Right, and ease of use. That's the other thing. Like, how easy is it to set up? Is this something where do I have to call somebody when my husband says, don't worry, honey, I can set it up in 10 minutes. If that 10 minutes turns into all day Sunday and, I'm taking the kids out because...
Right.
I love you, honey. Sorry, I'm really not.
It's also affordable. Relatively affordable, at $99, I think that you kind of, figure, well, it's an investment, but at the same time, I'm not paying $300 is a big difference. So that it's a little bit more attractive to kind of take that leap.
Yeah, it takes the edge off of getting into the technology in the first place.
So right. Something else that I want to talk about, we have touched on this in past editions, cutbacks in the world of journalism. Of course, journalism is changing. I think we all are familiar with that. Many of us get our content online and, you know, just certainly see cutbacks that are happening. And there's a story in broadcastengineering.com that basically compiled, I think, all of the cutbacks this year and said that so far, 360 journalists in TV newsrooms alone around the country were sent packing this year. And I guess I want to discuss this briefly and ask the question, is this more of the same, or will the bloodletting ever stop for traditional journalism? And I have to wonder, are we just dying a thousand slow deaths? Or does it somehow get to the point where, oh, guess what? Everything is manageable. And, you know, we no longer see these quarterly reports from, you know, the New York Times and Gannett and Hearst that your revenues are down 11% this quarter and so-and-so laid off 20 more people. Is there an end in sight, or is this just the long, slow, gradual decline of traditional journalism?
I don't think that we're going to ever lose traditional journalism. And I mean, in the case of investigative reporting or local news that needs to be reported, I mean, all that is still going to be there. I think that there is just a complete restructuring that's happening right now, and there's an evolution occurring. And you know, sometimes you have die-offs, and sometimes in evolution there are mass extinctions.
How about this? We got a little science. Science and media. Okay, so okay. No, but seriously, that's a really good perspective. As a scientist, when you look at what's happening now, do you compare it and say this is similar to extinction?
Right. I mean, I think it's, you know, there's a change in the environment. In nature, you have animals that are adapted to particular habitats, particular ecosystem niches in ecosystems, and then the environment changes and those places aren't there for them anymore, and they either adapt and find new places to go, or they don't and they die out. And this is,
happening.
It's exactly what's happening. And it's not, I honestly don't believe that journalism is going to go anywhere. It's just that the way that we've been doing it is changing slightly. People are going to different places to get their news. It's, you know, things are happening a little bit differently. But I mean, I'm just afraid that maybe the money to keep up, you know, the local journalism is what's going to lose out. And so people on the local level, that might be what is hurt the most.
Do you watch or read local news, Dr. Kiki?
I do a little bit. I mean, it's turning into more and more of, you know, following Twitter. Like last night, there was this huge fire here in San Francisco on Angel Island. And, you know, I was at a friend's house, looked out the window. What's that giant glow out the window? And so I immediately went on Twitter to find out what was happening. And Angel Island's on fire.
And how many of us followed? And I'm not saying this is the only place that we got our news from, but I didn't watch the conventions. I mean, I've watched a little bit of some of the debates, a little bit of the vice presidential, a little bit of last week's presidential debate. I didn't watch the conventions. And I read news reports on them. But, you know, I would be on Twitter in the evenings and just kind of, it was really fascinating to watch that stream. It's not the same as news. But, of course, that speaks to what you're saying is going on, that we are experiencing these bigger news events through Twitter and other places. And
yeah. And it's more social than just sitting and like watching it on the television or, you know, listening. You know, there are many different ways to get it, but I think it's making a little bit more social in the way that we do access it.
Yeah, I love to sort of play the, of course, it's very obvious for many people when they post their Twitters what side they fall on the, you know, the Republican or Democrat divide. I sort of find it interesting to play the game. If it's not completely obvious, can I guess from their Twitters which way they're going to vote? As you can imagine, most of my Twitter followers are big D's. Anyway, I didn't say anything about my political affiliation. So let's pick up on this whole idea of survival of the fittest, because I really do think that's what's happening in journalism. What do we think, Zadi, let's start with you. What do you think journalists need to, if they are, to keep this science analogy going, if they are to adapt, what do they need to do to still have jobs of some sort down the road?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think Dr. Kiki is correct. I mean, we're in this kind of age of crowdsourced information and verification, and we're getting our news from Twitter, and we're digesting all these like bite-sized
you know, news information and kind of developing our own perspective on the news. I think that right now what newsrooms, what they seem to be, I've spoken to a couple of really young journalists, and what they tend to tell me is like what they're looking for are these kind of one man, one woman bands, but someone who can produce, write, edit, be web savvy, and be a personality that the public pays attention to. So they have to be all these things in one. And so there is kind of like that dying off of the old guard and kind of having to build these new skills that kind of compete in the marketplace, in the market that we're in today.
I wonder if that really is sort of what's going on, that as we see more young journalists come out of journalism school. My father actually, he's retired, but he teaches journalism at University of Texas at Austin. And, you know, he teaches just an intro journalism class, news writing. And he now sort of operates under the assumption like this is for the web. You know, right. This is news writing. I mean, of course, he's teaching for a global sense of journalism, and I don't mean global in terms of all around the world, but global in terms of all mediums. But I think the underlying message is that probably your stories are going to wind up on the web, and you have to learn particular skills for that. So,
right, and you're also competing with citizen journalists, and so what does that dynamic look like as well? Because if you're getting your news on a local level from local people that are probably being more in depth with their news stories because they're actually living it, what makes a journalist important and stand out when they're kind of traveling throughout the news stories? So there's kind of this weird dynamic also that has to be figured out.
You know, I've talked to other print journalists, and I think one of the things that is going to make the difference is I think there are a lot of them that think, well, we have the sources, therefore we're always going to be okay. And I think, that's really not it anymore. It's a whole idea that, I mean, what I've tried to do on my own is, okay, can I be a brand? Can I be somebody who, exists apart from, I mean, obviously something like TV Week is very important to me, and it gives me a platform and all of that. But just how can you sort of move beyond that and be in different places, and also not quite operate as a consultant, but think about like the other things that you can do, whether it's even something as simple as introducing people to each other who could benefit, and that helps their businesses. I just think I think journalists have to get out of the ivory tower mindset of journalism, that they're the only ones that can produce this. I mean, you take somebody like Brian Stelter at the New York Times. He's very active on Twitter. And a lot of times in his blog, he quotes what people have said on Twitter. Even something like that, I think, is getting out of the box as a journalist, is he is recognizing what you said at the beginning of this conversation. It's the whole idea of the wisdom of crowds. And it's really not just assuming that all of the executives have the answers. And of course, he does plenty of stories where he just interviews executives. Mm-hmm. But reporting on what people are actually saying and responding. And that's what you can, that's what you get on a lot of these social media sites. Now, speaking of citizen journalism, Dr. Kiki, you sent this story to me, so actually I'm going to let you cue it up. It has to do with CNN had a report on Apple stocks plunging about a week ago. And what was the reason for that?
It was all because of citizen journalism, and some citizen journalists reported that Steve Jobs had ailing health. I think there was a heart problem or something like that. And basically, the stocks responded to that. People saw the news, Steve Jobs is ailing. What's going to happen to Apple? We're going to take our money out. And people are responding like random craziness right now because of how volatile the markets are anyway. But, I think it just was such an interesting effect that, this misreport, this report that came out. And, two things, I think that CNN, number one, it's kind of their fault for not vetting stories, and number two, for maybe not making it as apparent that these stories from citizen journalists aren't vetted, or that these stories are from citizen journalists, and maybe you should, take the accuracy with a grain of salt and do some more investigation yourself before jumping to conclusions.
That, of course, is the very risk in citizen mm-hmm. journalism, is a lot more people are getting their news from these other places, from, more unconventional sources. But how does the onus fall back on like a CNN, for instance, mm-hmm. in doing that? I mean, Steph, how do you see news networks starting to sort this out?
Well, I think that they're going to have to invest in their business model and their structure to make sure that there are people there that are vetting through the content, but quickly, because look how quickly this happened in this article. I mean, they've just got to be on it. I mean, separate from citizen journalism, I could talk about a situation even when videos are posted. If you're having copyrighted material up there, how quickly does that get reported and is that taken down? I've had a situation where, like that, where I had to report something that I realized was up for days that shouldn't have been up.
Wait, was this related to your show or to something?
No, something else where I saw, for example, some inappropriate content on an online video channel. And it turned out that they didn't even know it was on there. It took about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I'm just, you know, I think that the business model and the structure has to be, you know, how quickly can they vet through all this material and make sure that it's accurate and also make sure that it's not inappropriate?
It's interesting because it is, you're right, it is very much the same model. And of course, we have seen many examples of how video sites aren't able to move quickly. And mm-hmm. you go on YouTube and you can find, you know, something from a, trying to think of what TV network YouTube doesn't have a deal with right now, and I'm sure there's one. None is jumping immediately to mind, but of course you do find that stuff. It's the same challenge, and you know, mm-hmm. gosh, maybe this is just the muck that we all have to sort through right now. Right, we're evolving, Dr. Kiki. This is like we are evolving. Yes. Some of us are becoming extinct. Science analogy, but you know, yeah. It's sometimes you have to have a recognition, even just like as an observer, if we're thinking about ourselves as industry observers right now, that nothing is going to get solved today. You know, we're not going to get this all figured out, but that there is a lot of muck to be kind of, you know, walked through and sorted through and figured out. Sadly, I don't think a lot of people are willing to do that. And I think especially given the broader economic situation right now, whether it's stocks or whatever it is, I think there is a lot of we're just in a very reactionary state of mind. And I guess I would just hope that any type of news outlet, whether it's a blogger or a network, is doing their best to vet everything right now. I just want to touch on very briefly, Mojo HD has closed down. That is a high-definition service that was originally launched by In Demand, which is kind of a consortium of cable operators. Kind of interesting. The cable operators who probably have one of the most vested interest in high def, because of course they get additional money each month if you're a high def subscriber, usually depending on which one it is, but you know, $5 or $10 a month for a high def box and whatnot. So they just shut down Mojo HD, which had gone through a couple transitions. It had been In Demand or In HD, and then it became Mojo HD, which is kind of more of a male-centric high-def network. Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting is Mojo said there's already enough high-def programming out there. And I wonder if the future of high-def channels is more about simply kind of a porting of like the Science Channel or the Food Channel or Comedy Central into like a separate kind of like here's your HD feed rather than just having a channel that's just high-def. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that it's necessarily the best way to go. I mean, it again, I think limits the content that's going to end up going out. I mean, there's a lot of new HD content that's maybe being produced by independents that, you know, is not going to be included in the Science Channel or in, right. you know, these already HD channels, these already form, you know, those formats that are ready to plug and play. But, you know, so maybe, you know, I think it's just closing doors on people.
But I guess they weren't able to make it work.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, they're shutting it down because obviously, you know, I'm guessing there weren't enough advertisers to support it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just proves that technology isn't really the main thing, which that could be applied to anything. It's really about the content. I mean, I don't really think HD channels are necessary. I think about how YouTube handles their higher, you know, the higher definition HD content that's higher in rate, and it's really something that you can just switch on and off. So I would think that if the program is available in HD, you can switch in the, you know, you'll be able to switch that on and off as opposed to having an entire channel dedicated to HD, which doesn't really make much sense.
Hey Zadie, I have a question for you. This is just kind of an aside. So when you're watching like Lost or Battlestar Galactica, I think you like those two shows.
Yes.
when you watch those on your computer, Mm-hmm. Sort of like an aesthetic question. Now, do you go to your living room? Do you watch that? Do you put your laptop like on your lap? Do you and your husband watch together? I'm just sort of trying to picture, like, I love the whole like TV, like the big TV. I'm kicking back on the couch. I have my popcorn. So how do you simulate the TV watching experience?
It's funny that you say that. You know, I actually caught up on all of my Battlestar Galactica episodes through Netflix, and I was watching it on TV. And the last couple of episodes that were only available on Hulu, I watched on my laptop, and I was actually a little bit disappointed that I couldn't sit back and relax on my couch. So I had to bring the laptop over and kind of do that, but you don't get that same viewing experience. I do like that kind of sense of you can shut off the lights, just completely, you know, be absorbed into what you're watching and not have to worry about the many other different things that are going on your computer, right, or that it might, you know, the Wi-Fi might go down or anything else. It's just kind of like, don't worry, just watch.
And I guess that's sort of, that's kind of the trade-off, right? If we go for this whole, you know, broadband powered world, that's kind of the trade-off, is that it's not quite the same experience. So of course I can watch all of your fabulous shows though on my Apple TV, and that is wonderful. Now, speaking of all of your fabulous shows, interesting story, technology.newscientist.channel.tech.com. I'm not sure where it really came from. It's got a long URL, but it talked about, we'll link it up in the show notes. Don't worry if you want to see it. Web content contributors are in it for the glory. And this story, it was a very short story, but I think there was a researchers analyzed people who uploaded video to YouTube. So I think a lot of those videos can be looked at as sort of the one-off, the viral video, the wee hula hooping girl type of things. And, you know, saying that our web creators just in it for the glory. I thought it'd just be a fun jumping off point to talk about why we do what we do. Dr. Kiki, what motivates you to do the science word? I mean, that's kind of your new show, right? Mm-hmm. What motivates you to get up and, you know, do your makeup, turn the camera on, do the editing and all of the work that goes into that?
Well, I think part of it is that I really want to reach as many people as I can with fun, interesting science information. And like I'm driven by, you know, the love of trying to get people excited about science. And so, you know, that's where it all comes from. And that's what kind of inspires me. But when it comes down to, you know, what show am I working on and how am I picking what I'm going to do and the day to day kind of stuff, it's, you know, I don't know that it's the glory so much. I mean, there is the nice thing of like having people appreciate what you do. And I do like that a lot. It's neat for people to go, hey, that was really good what you put out, or, you know, but it's also good to get the critiques back because it ends up making me a better communicator in the end. So I think it's a bit of many things.
Steph, what motivated you to do? Are you in it for the glory?
I am absolutely in it for the glory.
Awesome.
No question. There's no question. I mean, my story, I was a typical New York City actor looking for a new way to get my work and my talents noticed. And it's just so interesting to see what's happened in the acting community just in the last 2 or 3 years and how the web has changed that. And so, you know, the traditional way that actors would get seen to get work, you know, used to knock on doors, drop off headshots to casting directors, put on showcases. And now you put something on the web, it could be 2 minutes, you email it to industry people just so that you could get your work seen. And so I started off, you know, as an actor, but now I'm an actor slash producer because I'm doing everything from creating the content. I'm my husband, who also directs and writes the show, he's creating content. We're creating together. We both do the editing. And I think it also just comes down to like, what is your own personal goal with your show? Is it, and then for me, it's not just getting seen and getting views, but I really am kind of developing a whole new career out of it, where I am, and as a result of the web, learning all these new skills on producing, on editing, and I'm basically just seeing where it takes me. I mean, I would love for it. I mean, my ultimate dream would obviously be to have maybe my own TV show and move away from the web into traditional media. But if that doesn't happen, that's fine because I've learned all of these new skills and I'm just basically seeing where it takes me right now.
Has it piqued your interest, Steph, in producing, in creating other content and not just being the on-camera person, but thinking, wow, I could put this other show together?
Definitely. Other people have definitely approached me. I'm constantly getting asked now, how do you produce a web show? How do you do this? How do you get it together? And I start explaining about budgeting and where to start and how to find locations and how to deal with the unions. And so I've learned all of this on my own. And so I've turned into, I mean, I wouldn't exactly call myself an expert yet, but I've definitely been consulting and talking with other people on how to start up a web show. And yeah, I could see myself headed in this direction where it could be a new career for me.
And so, Zadi, what's your motivation?
You know, you talk about glory and I'm thinking, what is the definition of glory? I guess it depends on what that is. But for me, it's like, you know, being able to communicate my ideas freely, having the freedom of, you know, expressing myself creatively. And, you know, for producers, being able to do what you love without that red tape there. And the landscape of the web is just so exciting. You just get to make up the rules as you go along. And just for me, what's so exciting is not so much using this as a jump off point to other forms of media, which I think is cool because you're building this whole kind of world around what you're creating. But what's so exciting to me is kind of just applying these new technologies and just seeing and being part of that evolution of entertainment. So for me, it's more of the role of the explorer and being in this new landscape and just kind of taking that machete out and just hacking away and just seeing what works. I mean, that to me is just so exciting because the sky is the limit with what's available, what you can do on the web. And I just want to explore that to the fullest and just, you know, all the way through immersive entertainment, what that means. What is entertainment going to look like 10 years from now? I just want to be part of that.
You made me want to do it. Yes.
You're inspiring. I want to do more. But you know what? That is what you find from people who are doing web shows. I mean, it is a labor of love. I mean, that's true. You know, we're not making Patrick Dempsey, Ellen Pompeo dollars. Understandably so. I mean, or even, you know, what a network news anchor is making or anything like that. But I think that what you're saying, Zadi, and what Steph is saying as well, is just that it is that freedom. But I think what you find also is just, it's this excitement that just clearly comes through when all of you talk about that. And that is what you find that most of the independent content creators have. They have a real passion for it. And I think about, you know, I'm going to answer my own question, sort of why do I do like the New Media Minute in my case? I'm going to tie it back to the whole extinction thing. I think it partly goes back to future-proofing. You know, in my case, yes, I enjoy it. It's also, I think it's something that you have to do as a journalist. It's why, you know, my father focuses on, you know, teaching for the web and news writing for the web. Okay, if I just remain boxed in as a, you know, just a print reporter, then I am kind of digging my own grave, right? I'm saying, okay, I'll be that dinosaur smoking because the Far Side cartoon. You know, to some degree, I mean, there are a lot of different reasons to do it, but that is one of the reasons that I made a decision to do it, because you have to see this is where, you know, this is where journalism is going. But anyway, it's a fun conversation. So something we'll keep talking about in future shows. I had a fun story that I've been trying to work in the last few episodes, and I think we finally have a couple minutes to chat about it now. Can music be too loud? There was a story in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago, using Metallica as an example, which I think is obviously the perfect example for whether music can be too loud. So basically, just to summarize the article, some fans think that, yes, this is the case and are complaining that the new Metallica album is indeed too loud and that the loudness has dampened some of the, quote, dynamic range in the music. The album seems tinny, poorly mixed, so on. And of course, albums in general are louder these days, and that is so that they can be heard on radios and on iPods. I don't know. It's just that this is kind of a fun story to chat about. Does anybody think music is too loud these days?
I think for audiophiles, it definitely can be. I was talking with somebody who's worked on producing music for a long time, and he's like, the Red Hot Chili Peppers are the worst in terms of going louder and louder and louder, and each album has been successively louder and louder and louder to the point where you actually, in terms of, you know, the nuances of, you know, the dynamics of music, you lose a lot. And so there isn't as, you know, it maybe not as special. You don't hear as much as you possibly would when you're listening to something on the radio or that's made for radio play.
Now, Zadi, I know that you're a huge music fan. You listen to a lot of independent music and you profile a lot of it in your show. As you're listening, are you noticing differences in quality or sound or the dynamic range?
I think it depends on the artist. Definitely, there is a difference in sound. It's kind of the sense of competition, and you tend to lose focus on what you're actually creating. I mean, I tend to like artists that are definitely playing more with sound and structure and kind of, you know, the rhythm, because that's what makes music so special. If you're constantly screaming, that message gets lost.
So there you go. Mm-hmm. that's our conclusion about music. Hey, I asked my Twitter friends if they had any questions. I said, you know, somebody had suggested this, and I'm sorry if I don't remember the name who suggested this a while ago, that I should let everybody know in advance who's going to be on the show so people can submit questions. So I have a couple questions here for the guests. So Hector Cortez wants me to ask Dr. Kiki if she's getting her own science show in Revision 3, because Rad Science on Pop Siren was great. Of course, well, we all want this to happen.
Thank you. I would love to do my own science show. I loved doing Rad Science, and I am still talking with everyone at Revision 3. My relationship with Revision 3 is not over. I'm still working with them, and we do definitely, you know, we keep revisiting it and see if it's something that's going to happen. Budget is a big concern at this point, so it's
so you
a matter
can set
of,
things on fire. You need to be able to do that in the budget, right?
I need to have a budget that's going to allow me to have big booms.
But seriously, can you share, I mean, without asking you to share, you know, financials or anything like that, when you talk about budget, what does it mean for somebody like you? Does it simply mean being able to do the experiments that are going to be most compelling on screen?
Experiments and also graphics. So being able to afford really nicely produced graphics and able to buy the props and the things. I mean, it's not just, you know, I could turn it into a different kind of show. You know, if I'm going to do a demonstration show, you know, there's a certain amount of money that has to go into buying all the stuff for the demonstrations. However, you know, I could also go in, make it a different kind of show where I go to people's labs and get other scientists to do stuff, and that would make it a little bit less expensive. So there are, you know, depending on what kind of a show we end up producing, that's going to determine the budget a lot. But you know, we're still talking
about
it.
Could you take the science word to Rev 3 or Next New or any of those playing for your imagination? Would you do that with, I mean, this is the one that you started on your own recently, kind of your science news tidbits.
Yeah, and I definitely would consider that. I'm just still fine tuning it and making sure that it, you know, figuring out exactly how I want to present everything. So, you know, I'm still accepting lots of, you know, feedback on the science word. It's not in its final format. Definitely, it's still evolving.
So all you file sharers out there, and actually my
newest episode is a little bit different. So
is that out yet?
It is out. I just put it out last Friday, and so my newest episode for the science word is out, and it's a little different.
You need to email it to me.
Okay.
Only, sorry, I just tend to forget things unless they're emailed. It's not personal. It's just that's how I get to watch.
I'll Twitter
this.
You.
Right.
I'll say,
Twitter
Daisy,
me.
Watch
that's,
this.
That's how I'll watch it. And then I'll tell everybody else to watch it, and two people will. And final other question was, sorry, it's also for Dr. Kiki. What is the future direction of the renewable energy podcast? What happens when you run out of energy types?
Oh.
Ashlaws wants to know. Thank you, Ashlaws, for submitting your question.
Thank you. Yeah, potential energy. We are going to be looking into all different angles. So, you know, an upcoming episode is not on an energy type per se, but we're going to be talking about the cap and trade system. So there are all sorts of different angles that we're going to be going into. You're talking about the energy grid itself, getting experts in on all sorts of different stuff. And so what I wanted to start out with is the big broad stuff. The first, you know, 10 or 15 episodes are the basics of energy. And then we're going to start going in much more in detail. We're going to start hitting very specific subjects. We are actually considering getting some video out there, so maybe expect some videos in your feed starting later this year or the beginning of 2009.
And of course, the whole "do you run out of ideas?" I think is a common question that you know any actor, journalist, or whoever, however, confronts. I'm going to toss that question as well to Zadi and Steph, and then I have a fun little segment I want to wrap up with. But Zadi, in your case, I mean, what do you do? I guess the question is, what do you do to keep the show fresh? I think it's probably less of an issue for shows like yours because it is so rooted in kind of, you know, cool new things that are cropping up. And of course, that's the whole point. There's always, if you're in the news business, and that's essentially what Epic Foo really is, you're in the news business, you have something to talk about, to write about. How do you keep the show fresh?
Yeah, in addition to kind of harnessing the public opinion, I think for us, it's really, we look at the show as kind of our, like, changing our shirts for our clothes, and we always want to make sure that we're staying fresh or we feel good about it. So as long as we're turning to each other, spurting out ideas, and then laughing, as long as we're laughing about what we're doing and having fun with it, that's kind of how we keep it fresh internally, because the last thing we want to do is kind of feel obligated to create a show that we really don't have any interest in creating. So as long as we're laughing, as long as we're, you know, putting out ideas out there, changing the show, changing the website every 6 months, changing, you know, the way we do things, putting new content in the show itself, changing the structure, we're all about just turning things up, you know, upside down and just doing new things, because that's the way we see the web. It's always this constant change.
I think knowing when to end a show, if it's, and this I think applies more to scripted shows, knowing when to end mm-hmm. a show is very important. This is something that Kent Nichols has talked about with Ask a Ninja a lot, you know, in terms of they're talking about evolving the show, making some changes to it next year. So it's important, I think, as a creator to be aware that maybe you can keep a show going for a very long time. Or maybe the best thing is to go out on top. Steph, for the Retributioners, mm-hmm. and because yes. it is a fictional, it is a script. I don't know how fictional it is. No. Have you really
Real
done
Real life
this?
Stories.
loosely autobiographical. Do you have a sense, is there an end date in mind for you? Or is this an ongoing show? Or are you already thinking, you know, maybe this could work for 10 more episodes and then I jump to the next project?
You know, I keep changing the answer to this question myself. We purposely chose a topic, and when I came up with the idea, I wanted something that had some longevity. So I knew that every single episode, it would be about me getting back at or seeking revenge on a different person. And you can really never run out of ideas, because it could be anywhere from getting back at an ex-boyfriend all the way to someone who stole your taxi. You know, it could be about anything. And so originally I had this idea of, okay, let's start with 10 episodes and let's just stop and take a break. But then, you know, what I realized is that I'm still building my audience and the word is still getting out about the show. And I don't want to stop. I'm enjoying it. People are enjoying it. I don't get millions of hits, but I do have a solid fan base that consistently watch the shows. So I'm going to keep doing it and just see where it takes me at this point. But I do keep changing the answer to that question, because sometimes I'll get, you know, really frustrated with myself and say, you know, I need a break. You know, this is so much work, but I'm so motivated to just keep going.
It's not,
so there's no end in sight yet.
And it's not dissimilar to a show like My Name is Earl, which is sort of based yep. on the idea of him making up. I mean, it's kind of the reverse Retributioners, but it's a similar concept. And of course, that's a show that's done well. So now what I want to do for a final little fun piece is I asked each of the guests to just give me a little nugget, kind of share the latest that's happening in their area of expertise. So Zadi knows more about indie music than anyone I know, with maybe the exception of Dr. Kiki. So Dr. Kiki's our science expert, so I'm going to throw the music question to Zadi. Cool new bands out there that you can recommend for listeners.
Actually, what we're listening to now is Peter Foxlot, who's a German musician. So Peter Fox is formerly of the band Seed, and he mixes hip hop with live orchestra and authentic drumline and DJ samples, and the sound that just comes out is really, really cool. He sings in German, so, you know, even though you don't understand it, you really get into the beat. Natalie Portman's Shaved Head is another one, Seattle band. I just love their name, and their music and lyrics are just completely irreverent. And Hadouken is another band that we're really listening to a lot now, and they have this really cool video game aesthetic, and they're just like hip-hop, dancehall, and techno all mashed up together with Nintendo Game Boy sounds, which is really, really cool.
Zadi, can you spell the last band?
Yeah, Hadouken.
Okay, cool. Good. Oh, those sound great. I love your descriptions. They're wonderful. Dr. Kiki, what are the coolest new developments in science?
Well, I think...
Is there life on Mars?
No, they haven't found life on Mars yet, but there's considerably just more and more evidence coming together that Mars has had water on its surface in large quantities and maybe, you know, has many of the ingredients or at one point did to have life. And, you know, every once in a while, there's one of those questions, you know, one of those little pieces of evidence that's like, oh, we found maybe a byproduct of something that was once alive. But, you know, there's still, you know, the jury is still out, but maybe Mars once was one of those planets. In terms of like cool science that's ongoing, I think the biggest, coolest stuff that's actually happening is in nanotechnology and the green sector, being able to create more efficient solar panels. And there's amazing research going on in that area right now. Thinner, flexible solar panels are being developed, and also fuel cell technology, being able to base the way that we get energy from the sun on the photosynthetic properties of plants, and then be able to take that to break water apart into hydrogen and oxygen and create a fuel cell that can then power things. And maybe we could have a sun-powered flower fuel cell plant in our house someday. It's very exciting stuff.
That's pretty cool. I bet you... Do you have the periodic table committed to memory like Lexi does on Grey's Anatomy?
I do not.
Oh,
but I did find a cool website. There's a cool website online, and I can't remember what it is, but I'll have to find it. There's a cool website that if anyone wants to learn more about the periodic table of elements, it's every element as it's been brought up in comic books.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, you need to find that. I want to see that link.
Yeah, so like any hydrogen, it's like every mention of hydrogen in a comic book ever. You know, it's just really cool.
That sounds like an epic foo segment to me.
Wow. Yes, definitely. I need that link.
Okay.
No, Steph, of course, since your show is about getting even, well, you can give us a quick and down and dirty tip for someone who wants to get even with an ex.
It has never been easier to get back at an ex than with the power of the web, can I tell you? And a picture can say 1,000 words. True story, I'll be very quick. There was an ex-boyfriend of mine from many years ago, and keep in mind I'm a happily married woman, who I happen to be friends with on Facebook, who recently, I guess the girl he dumped me for, put up some pictures of the two of them, even though they're not, you know, together anymore. And it bothered me a little bit. I was just like, you know, this was many years ago, but I don't want to see them together. So my point is that just putting a picture up of yourself with a partner in crime so that your ex-boyfriend or husband or whoever can see it, that's enough. You don't have to do much these days to put up a picture and piss someone off.
And make sure you look hot in it, okay?
Absolutely. Yeah. You have to look good.
Love it. All right, Steph, where can people find you online?
Oh, actually, I'm currently on the Access of Comedy presented by For Your Imagination. So if you go to accessofcomedy.tv, you'll find my whole web series over there.
Very cool. Zadi, where can people find you online?
Epicfu.com. That's EPICFU.com.
And Dr. Kiki?
You can find me at kirstensanford.com. And also my other, that's where Science Word is being published, blip.tv. Okay. And also thisweekinscience.com for my weekly radio show.
There you go. And you can find me, you can find my stories on tvweek.com.
Twitter.
Throughout the week. Twitter. We are over and out.